This is Dan Childs. Today's date is May 31st, 1973. The time is 8:45 a.m. I'll be interviewing John Pryor of Local Union 12075 of the United Steelworkers of America, District 29 in Midland, Michigan. The topics to be discussed are Local Union 12075, John Pryor's function in the union, and his opinions of its present and future existence.
What do you want to do?
Out of curiosity, tell me, who's the guy on the wall, first thing on?
The guy on the wall? Yeah. John L. Lewis. He was the one of the early presidents of the United Mine Workers and was, of course, one of the leading forces in the formation of the labor movement. He was the one of the founders of the CIO, the Committee on Industrial Organization. One of the reasons he's prominent is that he was a believer in the industrial form of unionism versus craft union. I don't know if that makes any sense to you or not. You know the difference between an industrial union and a craft union?
All I can think of is carpenters compared to somebody walking into a shop.
Yeah, okay. That's all it was, really. The early unions evolved, if you will, in a sense, from the guilds, which were skilled trades.
Yeah.
And that was the only kind of unions there were. And for quite a while, it was a, a little bit of a status thing, in a sense, that the skilled tradesmen thought they were the only people that were entitled to the joys of unionism, and these quads that worked in the new factories that were springing up, you know, they were just beneath their dignity a little bit. And Lewis was an advocate of the of unionizing the mass production industries. He felt that if you didn't have the industrial workers organized, that the craft workers would suffer. Well, the tradesmen, they wanted to go into, they were willing to organize a plant, I guess, after a lot of arguments. But they wanted to go in and organize, they wanted to split the plant up and get all the carpenters and all the steam fitters and all the blah, blah, blah. And so they'd end up with, 20 different unions in one plant. And Lewis and a number of other people felt no way to do it was organize on a plant basis and have all of these different crafts in together as a single unit, which would be an industrial union. And AFL was very, very bitterly opposed to that. They wanted to maintain their jurisdictional lines. So Lewis organized, or along with some other people, the Committee on Industrial Organization, which is now, they changed their name after several years, to the Congress on Industrial Organization, which is the CIO. Basically, it is made up of all the industrial unions, or was at that time, and the AFL was made up of basically all the craft unions, so that the amalgamation of the AFL-CIO, the big split, if you will, it was merely a coming together of the craft and the mass industrial unions merging together to one of the primary goals, of course, is political action, because they had some common fields there. But he was a real hot dog, I guess. He gets a lot of blame and a lot of credit, I guess, depending on what side of the fence you're on, but there's little doubt that he had a hell of an impact on it.
Yeah.
on the way the world turned, shall we say. He got some big scraps. If they want to talk about automation, why, management will usually refer to John L. Lewis. He advocated putting in machinery, automation, and so forth, and then getting a few more shekels for the guy, even though it meant less pay, or less workers, getting more pay for the people that remain. And management will usually, talk in loving terms about that. They probably don't like then to refer also to some of the other tactics that he used, because it was, whatever he did, as far as I can see, whatever he did, it was, he took and used the tactics that seemed to be working at the moment. And, if it meant going on a nationwide strike that was illegal, he felt that was the only way to go. He usually saw to it that's what happened. And, of course, he got himself problems with the law as a result. They didn't have a Watergate in those days, though.
Out of curiosity, how did this become classified as a United Mine Workers?
Okay, that's another. You, Lewis set up or helped organize, but I went over to the steel workers, if I remember rightly. A guy from the garment workers, I can't think of his name. But these people formed this committee on industrial organization. They were going out to organize the mass production industries as a last resort because they couldn't get the existing union structure to do it. As a result of this action, as a matter of fact, they got tossed. Some of them got tossed out of the AFL. But at any rate, they found that they could organize groups. UAW sprang from the steel workers. But, you know, all of these groups helped finance this committee, and it really helped the parent unions. They just grew leaps and bounds. Of course, this is about the time when you were getting into the Wagner Act. You were getting what they call the NIRA, the National Industrial Recovery Act. These things were coming into play, so the public opinion was somewhat turning, and these people, of course, obviously helped to form that public opinion that would be favorable to allowing workers to organize. But after you got the ball rolling, so to speak, Mr. Lewis, who was a bullheaded man, got into a big argument with the CIO power structure, even though he was the president of it. Roosevelt, let me see if I can remember rightly. 1939, there was the Memorial Day Massacre, as it's sometimes been referred to. There was a labor rally in Illinois. Gary? Chicago, Gary? Well, anyway, wherever it was, I can't remember where. There were federal troops called in. There were a number of people killed and injured and so forth. And Lewis was really jerked off that federal troops were allowed to do this. And, or that there were no, excuse me, I guess it should be the other way around, that there were no federal troops to protect the workers, but there were federal troops seemingly readily available to protect the mine owners' property or the steel owners' property. This particular thing involved the steel mills. But I guess as a result of that, he got extremely leaked off at Roosevelt, and even though he had supported him previously. Basically, John L. Lewis, as I'm given to understand, was basically a conservative Republican, which probably nobody believes, but basically he was a conservative Republican and supported Franklin Delano Roosevelt primarily because nobody in the Republican Party had any sympathies towards the plight of the workers, and that was his big thing. So he did support Roosevelt initially, but then after came time for Roosevelt to run in whatever the hell, 1940, I guess it was, or whatever, he said he would not support him, and that if the CIO supported Roosevelt, he would quit. Roosevelt, or Lewis said he would quit as president of the CIO. Well, they supported him, he quit. And this was, geez, 38 or 40, right in that area. He quit, and he was still, of course, president of the United Mine Workers, which was a separate international union. So now he was jerked off as the CIO, so he set up what was called District 50. And the United Mine Workers structure, they had primarily a bunch of geographical districts, which everybody, you all set up an organizational chart. You got to have a bunch of numbers on a table here. But District 50 for the mine workers was not geographic in nature. It was a jurisdiction. And the jurisdictional thing spelled out chemical workers, coke workers, allied to the coal industry, just anything and everything. And literally it was an industrial union. The United Mine Workers was, in essence, a craft union, if you want to look at it that way, in that it was a coal mine. If you looked at it real strictly, it would be restricted to coal mining operations. It didn't in practice go completely that way. District 50 was literally set up to compete with the CIO. Lewis was jerked off at the CIO now. So he sets up District 50, gave it this broad charter that, organized the unorganized, pumped in a lot of money to it, and was attempting, if you will, to outshine the CIO. Well, District 50 did grow fairly large, but it never competed with the CIO realistically. It, District 50, as a district within the United Mine Workers, grew to over 200,000 members, and in 1959 or so, well, we're going way beyond my time, but right in that 59 or so, when the Landrum-Griffin Bill, I believe it was, came into effect, part of that dealt to a great extent with the elections and the internal affairs of the union. And part of the effect of that bill was that members had to be able to vote directly for their officers. Prior to this time, District 50 was a separate district within United Mine Workers. So we did not vote, as a for instance, for John L. Lewis. We were just a separate district, and what they did at that time, they had conventions and this sort of jazz. Well, anyway, make a long story short, the net effect of that was that the United Mine Workers were faced with two choices. Number one, they could allow the industrial members, non-coal mining type people, to vote directly in all these elections and equally participate in all this good jazz. If they did that, since District 50 was at least as big or damn near as big as the parent organization, the coal miners would no longer control the United Mine Workers, which wasn't, you know, they weren't real happy about that. Or they could set up District 50 as a separate international union, say, here, go elect your own president and, you know, have your own goodies and be affiliated with us. And that would let them, the coal miners, if you will, retain their structure and yet meet the test of the law and having the District 50 people there have their own officers and all that good jazz. So they did that. They set up District 50. They severed the tie, if you will. It was no longer a district within the United Mine Workers. They set it up as a separate international union. It was called the International Union of District 50. But it was affiliated with the United Mine Workers in the same, generally the same fashion as any international union is that affiliates with the AFL-CIO. And that was the only connection. And in 1960, I guess it was, he appointed the officers initially in 1960 or whatever. They had our elections and all that crap. And then again in 65, had some elections, but we remained as a District 50, separate international union, affiliated with the United Mine Workers up until 1968, maybe, someplace in there. Anyway, at about that time, nuclear power was the savior of the world, you know, that's the thrust of things. And here in Midland, District 50 had under contract a number of chemical industries, and the chemical industry is a real heavy user of electrical energy in their chemical manufacturing processes. And about that time, the chemical industry was looking very closely at nuclear power. Of course, there's, you know, everybody was, after they blew the hell out of Hiroshima, why, that was going to, you know, immediately shoot electricity down lines and all that crap. And everybody was gobbling that goop up, you know. So the chemical industry said, hey, you know, we got to have this nuclear power. As is common, the union that's involved with an industry many times follows that industry's position. Now, this doesn't quite sound like it, right, but it's amazing how many times they will agree with a manufacturer regarding certain elements. He's doing it because his workers are involved, but his members are involved, and the manufacturer is saying, if I don't get X, whatever it is, I'm going to move the plant. Well, yeah. If you're looking out for the welfare of your membership, you try to keep the plant there. So that's what happened with nuclear energy. The International Union came out in support of nuclear energy. Well, obviously, the United Mine Workers and their coal miners were not in the least bit happy about that crap. So about in 68 or 9 or someplace in there, they said, hell, we're going to throw you guys out. Well, which they did. And it didn't have a great effect because we had our own officers, our own organization, all that crap. Really about what it meant was we didn't pay per capita to the United Mine Workers. We didn't have whole lot of dealings with them anyways. So we were tossed out then. In 1970 was our next international convention. I think it was 70. I may be off on my dates here, but at that time, we were getting into the, Tony Boyle was getting into a few problems, and there's a great hue and cry, primarily manufactured by some people who wanted to remain in power anyways, but there was a hue and cry to change the name. We were tossed out, and mine workers were suing or saying they were going to sue if we didn't change, you know, delete United Mine Workers symbol. And a lot of people within our organization were saying, we got to get rid of that. They're thinking we're a bunch of crooks like Tony Boyle is, you know, all this. So they changed the name to Allied and Technical Workers, and that was about 1970, I think. So, okay, we spent, I don't know, how many thousands of dollars on changing our stationery and the sign, you know, all this crap. Well, about within about a year, merger talks with the United Steelworkers were getting very close to completion. Now, we had a big internal fight in District 50. There was a lot of dispute about the election of officers that took place at the 1970 election. Is that right? 1970? I got the year right. The incumbent slate were trying to remain in power, mm-hmm. and there was a challenge from the former vice president, and it was a real bitter hassle. The incumbents won, in part, immediately thereafter, they wanted to put into effect the steelworkers merger. Well, the group that lost the election, the guy that lost the presidential election, says, hey, wait a minute, we think they screwed us on the election in the first place, in the second place. If this merger thing goes through, we'll never have another crack at, you know, throwing the bums out, because they'll be merged into steelworkers and there will no longer be an international union. So he got court orders and went through a lot of legal jazz, and that merger business got held up until October of last year, 1972. So we, what it amounted to is, we were an international union or District 50 for some number of years. For about a year and a half or 2 years, they changed the name to Allied and Technical Workers and deleted United Mine Workers. And now we are fully, completely merged into United Steelworkers. We're no longer a separate international union. We are just steelworkers, and we haven't changed all the names yet. It's going to be on our sign out there for District 50, which everybody's pissed off about. I don't quite feel like spending $600 for. So the organization names and went through a lot of hassle in a very short number of years, which is accounts somehow for our relatively weaker turn to talk in the company. We've had all this internal hassle and it hasn't helped.
When was it originated in this particular town, I guess?
In this town, this local? Yeah. 19, early 40s. First contract was signed, I think, in 41, I believe. I prepared a note thing upstairs. I can go up and get that. Just hold on a minute.
Okay.
I'll give you this. And
great.
It's, what did I say, 1938 election of officers was held. July 8th, 1941, an LNLRB election was won by Local 12075. The union won bargaining rights, 1941. The agreement was signed September 15th, 1941. Well, that gives a brief background of some of the good jazz. It only goes up to 1967, hasn't been updated as far as the local's concerned, but give you an idea of some of the dates.
Well, we've covered stuff that, you know, kind of general. I'd like to hear some of the stuff that you're into personally. So I guess I'd like to know, like, when did you join the union, and what is your particular job within the union, stuff like that.
Okay. I hired in 1955. as far as the plant's concerned. Of course, obviously, you can't belong to an industrial union until you're an industrial employee. Well, hired in 55, I worked here for the Midland location, but not in the Midland location. That sounds weird, but I worked at Indian River, out of town a lot. That was the heyday of research, in case nobody knows. They were spending money so goddamn fast that you just shovel it out quick as you could, and you got promoted. If you spent $1 million more than the other guy did, why, I gave you a promotion, I guess. But yeah, that's what it seemed like in our department. Anyway, 55 to 57, I worked out of town mostly and had, I'd say, minimal or no contact with the union as a member, but that, you know, be a name-only deal.
What did your family think of this? I mean, like, I don't know if you were married.
Well, I wasn't married then. I was single, could care less about union or any other damn thing, to be honest about it. We were not the concerned generation. We were, where's the next beer come from type of thing. I'm not so sure that doesn't exist today anyway. Yeah. But anyway, that was a wipeout. And then, of course, I went to the Army for a couple of years. I came back, and I moved over here. I got married while I was in the Army. And I moved over here, and I still didn't get too active. It would have been, okay, I came back in 59 and moved over here in 1960, so that I was had an apartment over here initially. And it was about that time when I was here physically, or, you know, living here in the area, that I started to at least have a notion of what the hell a union was. So I took the job of department steward. It was about the way it started out. Started attending a few meetings and that sort of jazz. And I don't know whether I don't think it should be represented that I started out a devotion. my memory isn't real good, but my judgment would be that at the time, there were some dudes that I'd be running around with that we might be going to the union meeting and go out drinking afterwards, and that's how I got the union meeting, probably. But anyway, after you got involved, well, I served as department steward. Department steward, under our existing agreement, for every 35 people, you know, in a department, title of one steward. And the steward, of course, is the man, really, that is the union. It's unfortunate that he's the guy that gets the least amount of attention, but he is really the important man. I didn't know it at the time either, but with the advantage of a different perspective, you can see how important it is. But that, I don't know, I served as steward for, I don't know, quite a few years, on and off. You're elected by the people. And any complaint, any request, any dealings that an employee may have with management, he can come to you first. Well, literally, any dealings the employee has, if he wants to ask you about it, you're the first guy he asks as the department steward. And that job, I don't even remember why the hell I took it at the time. I don't know what the hell on. Sometimes, you know, the way this goes, you may be the only cat that'll do it. Other times, everybody and their brother wants to do it. Different people run for different reasons, and I don't know why the hell I did. But anyway, I got into it, and the job I was working on was a research job. Supposed to be such a wonderful deal, but they talk about the boredom of an assembly line job. My job wasn't boring, but you sure as hell wondered if you're ever doing anything that really amounted to anything, because just the way the organization was, you could be in a big hurry to get out something and bust your nuts to get it out, and after it was all said and done, nobody really seemed to give a damn. But when you got working as a union representative, even as a department steward, you got into problems, and you could actually see you were doing something. The guy was coming to you and saying, I've got this, or I got that, some problem, or whatever the hell, and I don't know who to go to, what to go to. And it's amazing how many people, skilled tradesmen, janitor, whatever, who have literally no concept of where the hell to go. They're just lost in a, you know, big numbers game in industry, and they don't know where the hell to go. They're crude cookies, but they don't know where the hell to, what to do, how to go about things or anything. And you find yourself in a position that a guy can come to you with a, what seems to be a simple damn request, but he can't seem to get anything happening, and you can do it. And it just got to be a different kind of a thing, if you will, than working for the company. Obviously, you were still on the payroll and everything, and primarily you spent your time on the job, but more and more you found that attending at meetings, you paid a little more attention to newspapers. For instance, I subscribed to a number of different newspapers at that time, of course, chemical industry. There were three major unions involved, oil, chemical, and atomic workers, and the international chemical workers, and you'd subscribe to their papers and give you, you know, a notion of what the hell other people are doing in the industry. So, after some time, I also was appointed to the what was called the laboratory committee. And back some years ago, it was quite active. The company was willing to negotiate with the union, and we got involved quite a bit in terms of setting up agreements for what we called our research operators, pool operators, and also for the research technician, which happens to be what I am. And you got involved in testing the advancement for the agreement for advancement call for a guy to take a test. Your supervisor made up part of it, and there was also a general part, applied the whole plant. And this is a hell of a group of people. We had 525 research technicians at one time. We had upwards of 300 pool operators, so it was a hell of a workforce. And there were a lot of people taking tests and advancing, I really liked that because when we went in, at that time, we checked, proved a test to be given to make sure it was at a certain level so that it wasn't an arbitrary thing of just saying, I think it's all right. We argued about what the hell the level should be, tried to see that it was, you know, some sort of a norm, mm-hmm. if there is such a thing for tests. And then we used to check it, and the company also checked it. And then we'd haggle together about the score. Obviously, the company taking a position that you had it right or you had it wrong. You know, a test type of situation is supposed to be, there is a question and only one question, and there's only one answer. And I think more and more today we realize that there's one question on paper, and if you got 100 guys taking a test, you probably got 50 different questions that people are perceiving. Yeah. But the company, of course, they, you know, looked on a little score sheet, and, well, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And when we checked it, or at least whenever I was involved in it, I think probably most of the guys followed that philosophy. You went at it with the notion, the guy took a test, is there anything he did right? And you give him credit for whatever he did right. And which means you've got to spend a lot more time and so forth on it. But we were then serving, or as I saw it, we were serving as a representative for that man in scoring the test. We weren't giving him anything. We weren't cheating. We were saying, if you did something right, you get some credit for it. And as a result, then, we would score these things independently. The company would score theirs, and we'd get together and